Introducing Paul F. from Phoenix, Arizona.
I'm Paul Fisher. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Cactus. I tell you, this conference rocks. Wow. It is a privilege and an honor to be here, and also I have to be crazy to be here tonight, to stand in front of the biggest group of people who are probably the most arrogant, judgmental, critical people on the planet, and come up here and talk to you about God. I gotta be crazy to do that. You know what I'd like to do before I get started? If you will bear with me, let's have all the worker bees stand up. All the worker bees of this conference, stand up. Let's give them a hand. To the new people, I would like to welcome you to the greatest organization on the planet. I love those sobriety countdowns. It's such a kick. I mean, it's such a celebration for each and every one of us. You know? See, my 20 years of sobriety does not belong to me. It belongs to this program. My sobriety does not keep me sober. I will simply share with you what I was told when I came into these rooms. And that is, if you will take this book and you will follow the recipe in this book, I can guarantee you, you will never, ever have to drink and use again. Ever. And you don't ever have to live the way you were living before. That's what they told me when I came into these rooms. Now, I'd like to sit back here and tell you that when I first came into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that it was a bundle of joy to be here with you people. And that was not the case. I went to my first meeting when I was 19 years old. And everybody in the meeting was at least 30. And that's old. When you're 19, that's really old. There were even people that were 40 and 50 in that room. I remember sitting in that meeting thinking, oh man, I've ended up in AA. End of the road, no more fun. I looked around all these people that were so old. I thought, man, if I was that old, I'd stop drinking too. These sorry people, you know? And I remember sitting in that meeting, looking around the room and thinking, and listening to the people talking and thinking, man, I sure am glad they're here. Listen to that guy over there. Man, he needs this program bad. Look, oh my God, listen to that guy over there. Jesus, he needs help. I'm really sorry that he has to come here. Now, what happened for me was, for the next 12 years, I bounced in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could not stay sober. And I was confused. And I didn't understand why I couldn't stay sober. And I saw people around me staying sober. Now, in that 12 years, I did fellowship. I knew a lot about fellowship within Alcoholics Anonymous. But I didn't know anything about the program. You see, in that 12 years, I was what my first sponsor referred to as being severely intelligent. And when he said that to me, it sounded like a compliment, but it did not feel like one. I came into this program thinking I was smarter than every single person in the room and I could do less than you and get more out of the program than you. And as a result, I couldn't stay sober. And I almost died several times. Now, there were a couple of minor things that I overlooked in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. A couple of minor details that I failed to see were really that important. You know, things like doing the steps, reading the book, getting a sponsor, learning how to pray and meditate, learning how to do evening review, learning how to be of service to my fellow man. I didn't do those things. And as a result, I did not stay sober. And when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, August 26, 1981, my biggest fear, the biggest fear I had, is that it would not work for me. It simply would not work. Because I would go to meetings, and I would see people staying sober. And I thought that there was something fundamentally wrong with me, deep within me. And you people frightened me, because you people talked about things that I knew nothing about. You talked about honesty. I didn't know anything about honesty. You talked about love. I didn't know anything about that. To me, love was a horizontal act. And sometimes it was vertical. You know, I mean, that's what I thought love was. I didn't know. You know, when I came into these rooms, and it's not that my language was bad. It's just that that's all I knew. I didn't know anything else, you know. So when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not come back here because I wanted to get sober. That's not why I came back. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was in pain. And because I had gone out and I had committed a crime, and I was facing 25 years in the penitentiary. So that's pretty good motivation for me to get back here. And that's what I did. Basically, what happened was one night in a blackout, I assaulted three police officers. Woke up in the county jail, 23 stitches over my left eye, almost lost my left eye. Couple of broken ribs, could hardly walk. I thought, man, that was a bad car wreck that was in. No, that's not what happened. Phoenix PD doesn't take kindly to assaulting their officers. They just simply don't. And that's what brought me back here. And as I stand up here tonight and look across this room full of people, I'm feeling so blessed. And my heart just feels so full right now. Can you imagine what this camp would be like if we were drinking? Jesus. This camp is fortunate, isn't it? Very fortunate, yeah. And I believe that the Phoenix is thankful that I'm sober too. I don't doubt that. So what happened to me was I came back to AA. I didn't really do anything differently. What happened was something different happened to me. The first thing that happened to me was, my sponsor picked me out. I didn't pick him out. He was a guy from New Jersey who used to break legs for a living. And he came up to me and he said, "I'm going to be your sponsor." I said, "Okay." And he was big. He was about 6'4", and he weighed about 260. So when he would come up to me and say, "I'm going to pick you up for a meeting," I didn't argue. The reason I went to meetings in the beginning is not because I wanted to go to meetings, because I was scared. I was scared he was going to kick my ass. To tell you the truth. That and the fact that I was facing 25 years in the penitentiary. And this is what this man did for me. This man gave me the dignity of finding out for myself if I really belonged in this fellowship. You see, I needed to find out if I was a real alcoholic. Because until I find out that I'm a real alcoholic, I'm not going to have what I call a first step experience. And that first step experience means I need to get in touch with the hopelessness, the futility, the despair, the anxiety, the fear, the panic that I had when I was drinking. Because if I don't have that experience, I have no desire to find a power greater than me. See, what I've discovered in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that there are only two things that are going to treat my alcoholism. Only two. A whole lot of booze or a whole lot of God. That's it. And I came in here and I had an itch. The big book refers to it as being irritable, restless, and discontented. And that was me when I first got sober. I was restless, irritable, and discontented. I mean, you take an alcoholic addict and you take his medicine away from him, he's got a hell of an itch. It needs to be scratched right now. And that's what my sponsor did for me. What he did was he started taking me through this book. And he gave me the dignity of finding out. See, at the beginning of the meeting, I identified myself as a recovered alcoholic. I am not a recovering alcoholic. I am recovered. You know what that means? That means I'm not suffering anymore. I'm free. The authors talk about this. They talk about being recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. The hopeless state of mind is the mental obsession that the authors talk about. The hopeless state of body is the phenomenon of craving. See, as a result, I have a sponsor who had what I refer to as Big Book Sobriety. He took me through this book. And he pointed out to me, he said, there's a recipe in this book. He said, if you will follow this recipe, I can guarantee, the authors guarantee it. The authors guarantee that I'll never drink again. And there's no reason why each and every one of us in this room don't ever drink again. There's no reason for it. It's like a cookie recipe. If I have a cookie recipe and I take this oatmeal raisin cookie and give it to Ron, I say, here, check this cookie out, man. He says, hey, that's a good cookie. Can I have that recipe? I say, sure. He goes home, he makes the cookies, he comes back and he says, hey, that cookie didn't taste right. I said, well, did you follow that recipe? Well, sort of. You know, there was some stuff in there I didn't really think needed to be put in there. You know, I put a little more, maybe I put in a little more sugar than your recipe called for because I wanted a kick out of it, you know. It's not going to turn out the same. And that has been my experience in these rooms. And that's what that sponsor did for me. It was absolutely essential for me to have a first step experience. See, there's only one thing that separates me from the non-alcoholic. You guys like this jacket I'm wearing? See it? Looks good, doesn't it? Jeez. I'm taking it off. So what he did is he took me through this book to find out if I was a real alcoholic. You know what separates me from the real from the non-alcoholic? Only one thing. It's called the phenomenon of craving. Dr. Silkworth is very clear about this, where he says that the phenomenon of craving never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Never occurs. Dr. Silkworth is very clear. He talks about the phenomenon of craving as being a physical condition, not a mental condition, the physical condition of craving. In other words, what happens in my head is called mental obsession. Authors are very clear about that. After I put the alcohol in my body, I experience a phenomenon of craving. That's how I know I'm an alcoholic. I remember the first time I was asked that question. Did you experience a phenomenon of craving? I said, no, I just wanted more. That's what a craving is, you know. And then Dr. Silkworth goes on to talk about having an allergy to alcohol, an abnormal reaction. And I remember being asked, did I have an abnormal reaction? Well, I think I'm allergic to alcohol. Because when I drank, I broke out. I broke out in handcuffs and orange coveralls. I mean, I did crazy, stupid, insane shit. I remember the very first time I drank like an alcoholic. I drank for the reason of a resentment. Because I wasn't allowed to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. And I was confined to my house. I don't remember how old I was, 13, 14 years old. And I wasn't allowed to go anywhere. My parents were alcoholic, and they had an excellent alcohol supply. And I went in the kitchen, and I only had one drink. Only one. Now, that drink was a big tumbler, about this big. And I went into their cabinet, and I poured a little bourbon, a little wine, a little vermouth, little gin, a little vodka, and I shook that sucker up, and I drank it all down in one sitting, and I got good and sick. Now, guess what I did the next day? I went in and I did the same shit. That is called an abnormal reaction. The thing I love about this book is it gives me the dignity of finding out if I belong in this room. I'm going to explain to you why I'm putting emphasis on this. Because until I find out who I am, I will not know where to go. I sponsor a guy who was sober almost 10 years in these rooms. And he was not an alcoholic. He has an addiction to another substance called cocaine. That non-addictive substance, you know. And what happened for him is he went to treatment and they told him, well, since you're an addict, you're an alcoholic too, so just go to AA. And the guy was miserable. You know why he was miserable? Because his sobriety was based on a lie. It was based on a lie. He had the itch, and he couldn't scratch it. He was irritable, restless, and discontented. And I've seen that time and time again in these rooms. You are the only one that can determine that. However, the authors in this book give me an outline to follow to determine if I belong here, to find out if I'm really an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm the alcoholic that they talk about on page 21, who's lost all control. I am the alcoholic who has lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not drink. I remember going to meetings and hearing people saying, I choose not to drink today. Okay, let's check that out for a second. Now, if I can choose to not drink, what am I doing in AA? If I have the power to do that, another one I heard too was, don't drink and go to meetings. What? Now, wait a minute. I come to you, I'm weighing 130 pounds, and this is after I put on a little bit of weight, and I thought I was looking good, okay? And I come in here, I got no power. I've been bouncing in and out of AA for 12 years. I can't stay sober. So don't tell me to not drink and go to meetings. Because if I had the power, I would have already done it. I don't have that power. Now, some of you may have had this experience, maybe you haven't. But I would go to meetings and I would hear stuff like that, and I thought, that sounds novel, that sounds really cool. So the next meeting I go to, I'd look around and make sure nobody was in that meeting that was in the one before. And I would parrot what was said. And I thought I was speaking the truth. What I discovered as a result of going through these steps in this book, that is not the truth. I am no more physically sober today than I was on my first day of sobriety. I am no closer to God today with 20 years of sobriety than I was on my first day of sobriety. Because I cannot get closer to God. Because my book tells me that the fundamental idea of God can be found deep inside of every man, woman, and child. Inside. So if God is inside here, how can I get closer to Him? It's impossible. Do I have a deeper understanding of God today? Yes. Am I more physically sober now than I was then? No. I'm no more physically sober now than I was the very first day I walked into AA. So you see, He took me through this book, and I started taking, He had me take statements in the book and turn them into questions. And He asked me, like it says on page 24 and 34, am I willing to consider that I have lost the power to choose whether I will drink or will not drink? Now, if I had the power to drink or to not drink, why didn't I exercise that power before? Because I didn't have it. I simply didn't have it. I'm not the alcoholic that can come into these rooms and stay sober on my own. It is impossible. So through the work in this book, what I discovered was that in that 12 years that I was bouncing out of AA, I had it backwards. I had this program totally backwards. I thought you guys were going to show me how not to drink. That's not what this program is about. If there's anybody new in here, Alcoholics Anonymous is not about not drinking. Doesn't say that in the book. On the contrary, the authors encourage us to go out and try some controlled drinking. There's only one mention in the book, within the first 164 pages, where it's mentioned, where abstinence is mentioned. And Dr. Silkworth makes a mention where he says that total abstinence is the best approach. See, I thought I could come in here, you were going to show me how not to drink. In other words, you were going to give me the power. You were. And then I was going to find a higher power, and then I was going to stay sober. I had it totally backwards. You see, if step one was about not drinking, we could use one word to describe step one. You know what it would say? It would say, quit. Or stop. It doesn't say that. It says, I admitted I have no power. I have no power. The second half of step one tells me that I need a new manager. I can't manage my life. If I was doing such a good job with my life, what am I doing here tonight with you people? I'm telling you, with the sobriety I have, I still can't manage my life. I still have no power. So you see, step one guarantees me one thing. It guarantees me I am going to drink. Step one is not about hope. It's about hopelessness. And until I have that experience of hopelessness, I have no desire to find a power. You see, a man with no desperation has no desire for mercy. So you see, it was absolutely essential for him to drive that into my fat head. that I had no power. And he pointed out to me, is there anything that you can do to keep you sober? No, there is absolutely nothing I can do to keep myself sober today. Nothing. You know the topic that really gets me in meetings? What are you doing today to keep yourself sober? Really? There's only one right answer to that question. Nothing. I don't have any power. I cannot keep me sober. It is impossible. So until I have that first step experience, I cannot move on to step two. It is impossible. If I don't have the desperation of a drowning man, I'm screwed. Because I'm not going to have any desire to seek a power greater than me. So basically, this is what my sponsor did for me. He took me through the steps really quick. When I say quick, I mean less than 60 days. He had me through all 12 steps. And in that period of time, I'd already done a fourth. I was actively making my ninth step amends. I was doing daily prayer and meditation. I was doing a daily 10th step, which is not an evening review, and I want to talk about that in a little bit. There's a lot of confusion about that in these rooms. I was doing an evening review, which is part of the 11th step. And then he cut me loose. He said, go work with some others. Now, what happened to me as a result of that first step experience, desperately needing to find some power to keep me sober, and as a result of going through those steps, I had a spiritual experience. See, what the steps do for me is they push the ego aside far enough so that I can experience the grace of God, so I can gain access to that power. That's what keeps me sober. And as a result of that, he cut me loose, said, okay, now go work with other alcoholics. And I would go to meetings and people were saying things to me. I mean, I'm 2 months sober. This guy cut me loose. He said, go work with other alcoholics. And do what? Take them through the steps. See, I was confused. The program and the fellowship are not the same. The program is the 12 steps contained in this book. This is not the program. This is fellowship. This is cool stuff, man. I need to do it. Okay? But I need to be really clear. It's not the program. And I would go to meetings and people would start slamming me and start saying things like, you can't be sponsoring people, you're not sober long enough. Where does it say that in our book? Where does it say that? Can you imagine this? Can you imagine? I see Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson didn't know what he was doing. He didn't have a clue. There was nothing scientific. About him going and seeing Dr. Bob. He couldn't find his ass in the dark. His life was a mess. He was sober 6 months. All he knew was that he sensed that he had to talk to another alcoholic. So what does he do? He hooks up with his butt doctor, okay? That's what he was. He was a butt doctor, okay? We're not going to spend any more time on that. That could get really funny. But anyway, he hooks up with his butt doctor. What does he do? He doesn't talk about the drama of his drinking. He does not talk about the drama of his drinking. You know what he talked about? He talked about his inner experience. He talked about his inner experience of hopelessness, anxiety, fear, despair, panic, wanting to stop drinking, but he couldn't. That's what he talked about. See, that's the reason when I go out and speak, I do not talk about the drama of my drinking. I'm going to tell you why. Because in that 12 years that I was sober, not sober, that 12 years I was bouncing out AA, you know what I heard? Drunkologues. Now check this out. I'm new. I'm sitting in the back of the room, and I'm hearing some guy talking about the penitentiary. I'm hearing some guy talk about how many cars he's wrecked, how many marriages he's had, how many bankruptcies he's had. I'm sitting back there thinking, I've never been to prison. I've never wrecked a car. I've never been married. I don't belong. You know what drunkologues do? They create distance. They do not create relatedness. I can sit here tonight and share with you my inner experience. See, the drama is unimportant. See, that's what coffee is for. The coffee before the meeting and after the meeting. That's where we, talk about that stuff. But not in the meeting. Because that's what I heard in that 12 years. And when I came back, some guy grabbed me who didn't talk about the drama of his drinking. He talked about his inner experience. He talked about being the Jekyll, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I never felt like I fit anywhere. I remember having a fantasy about that. And one day I thought a spaceship was going to show up and a voice was going to come out and say, you can come home now. I didn't feel like I belonged. And when I found alcohol, I belonged. Man, I was a good dancer when I drank. Or so I thought. I was good with the ladies, or so I thought, until they talked to me the next day. I'm going to try to cut this as short as I possibly can, because I know all of you are anxious to get to that 13-step dance. But, you know. You know, I'm not putting down 13. That's what they are. You know, come on. You know, I used to go to those dances when Yes was around, before it turned to ASCII Paul and all. This used to be called Yes, for those of you that are Yes youth enjoying. So I used to go to those dances too, and I was never there looking for, you know, Miss Right. I was looking for Miss Right Now, you know. And you know, on that note, now that I think about it, it reminds me of an experience I had with my sponsor. And this is one of the very few times that my sponsor asked me to do something that wasn't in the book. And he said, Paul, I want you to not have a relationship in your first year. Now, my mind heard, A. He said A, didn't he? That is singular. Right, that's what, oh, that means I can have 3, 4, 5. And I thought everything was going well until one night I walked into a meeting and 3 of them were standing in the corner talking to each other. I think relationships are beautiful in early sobriety. You know why? They'll get you closer to God, and they'll get you closer to your sponsor. Guaranteed. Who am I to say that the person you meet isn't going to be the love of your life? I don't know that. I'm not God. Your life is none of my business. My job is to carry the message that's contained in this book. See, as a result of my sponsor taking me through this, what I began to discover was that I began to discover that I was hearing a lot of misinformation in meetings that is not in the book. And this is what I've learned. If it's not in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it is not Alcoholics Anonymous. We're killing people. We're losing people. We're losing a lot of people because of some of the crap I'm hearing in meetings that are not contained within the first 164 pages. I'm sponsoring guys right now that are 30, 60 days sober, and I'm telling you, man, they're on fire. What I began to notice in that first 60 days that I was sober, I began to notice that my sobriety looked really different than the guys I got sober with, and they just, you know, by their 6th month, they got around to their 4th step, and some of them didn't stay sober. The point is, my sobriety really looked different. And I go to meetings, and it's really easy to tell who's doing step work. It's not hard to tell. It's easy. Those people are on fire. They have an enthusiasm for life. They have an excitement for life. We don't take ourselves as seriously. See, I know I can't take myself seriously. You know why? Because I am the joke. I can't take myself seriously. As a matter of fact, when I call my sponsor up, after Todd called me and asked me to come and do this deal, I called my sponsor up and he said, my goodness, couldn't they find anyone? Are they that desperate? See, I need that. I need that. So he took me through these steps. Now, when I got to step 2 and 3, this is where I ran into some problems. I had some difficulty with that because as a kid, I grew up in a parochial school, and I was surrounded by those nuns, and I was convinced, absolutely convinced, that they were the ones that taught the Nazis the art of punishment. So when I would go to meetings, and I heard you say God, I didn't hear you say God, I heard you say God. That's what my head heard. I heard, oh, here it comes. Here comes the punishing God. Here it comes. And then he pointed out to me where it says in the book that I can choose a God of my understanding. See, my book's real clear. My book says that I have a dilemma. Lack of power is my dilemma. And they tell me on page 45 what the purpose of the book is. And that is to find a power greater than myself which will solve my problem. So I'm not the smartest kid on the block, but I did put this much together. Okay, if the book is about finding a power greater than me, that means finding a God of my understanding. If the 12 steps are in the book, what is the purpose of the 12 steps? Find God. That's what it is. See, I had it backwards. So until I had that first step experience of hopelessness and futility and despair, I was in no position to seek a power greater than me. And it didn't have to be the God of the clergy or of the church or of my parents. It could be a God of my own understanding. And from there, I can move on to step 3 and make that decision. Now, I heard a lot of crazy stuff in the meetings about higher power. You know, once again, I received a lot of misinformation in the meetings. See, one of the worst things I could do for myself as a sober member of this fellowship is go to meetings and pay attention to the opinions of people who are given in the meetings. You want to learn how not to do a four-step? Listen to the opinions in the meetings. See, what I did in that 12 years, I was given opinions on experiences I never had. See, if you have an experience with something, you can help me. But if you don't have experience with it, you can't help me. You see, you can take this book and you can flip to any page, anywhere in the book, anywhere. Do it sometime at random. Take the book and just randomly flip through the pages and stop randomly and read on that page. And you'll find one of two things. You'll find the author's experience with their powerlessness or their experience with a solution. Isn't that beautiful? And it's so simple. So simple. So I had a hard time with this God thing, and I was hearing a lot of misinformation. I mean, it's some wacky stuff about higher power. Oh, yeah, it could be a doorknob, you know. It could be a ghetto blaster. Or maybe you got one of those great big rocks in your backyard. And I'm not talking about the rock that they talk about in Cocaine Anonymous, by the way. I'm talking about the big old huge rock on the ground, okay? And I did a test with that one day. And the test was this. I took that rock and I applied it to the 12 steps. Came to believe that a rock could restore me to sanity. Made a decision to turn my will and life over the care of a rock. Admitted to my rock, another person, myself, the exact nature of my wrongs. Sought through prayer and meditation to prove my relationship with my rock. It doesn't fly. You know why? Because it's not in the book. It's not in the book. It simply had to be a God of my understanding. No matter how limited it was. See, I can't think my way into God. I can only do it from my heart. That's the only way that I can do it. And I had a couple of difficulties in early sobriety with that. I started getting disillusioned in early sobriety because of what I saw happening with people. For example, a good friend of mine went to a mutual friend's house and knocked on his door, and my friend Brad opened up the door, and my friend Bill said, "Hey, watch this," and blew his brains out. And this was a guy who looked really good on the outside. He looked really good on the outside. So even though I had gone through the steps and I had had a spiritual experience, see, I was confused because I would go to meetings and I would hear people talking about this spiritual awakening. I had my spiritual experience. I had a spiritual awakening. When am I going to get mine? Where's mine? Where's mine at? You know, I've gone through these steps. I'm doing what you tell me to do. Where's my spiritual experience? I'm not getting it. There was no burning bush for me. And the old timer pulled me aside and he said, "Do you have a compulsion to drink today?" I went, "No." That is the spiritual experience. The book talks about an entire psychic change. In other words, my thinking changed. I have changed nothing in 20 years in these rooms. What has happened for me is that as a result of doing the work as outlined in this book, the change has come to me. That you've provided me with an environment where change can take place. You see, if I had the power to change my behaviors, I would have already done it. I have no power. So another way of saying it is each one of those steps illustrates the same thing, and that is I have imperfections and I have limitations, and I will always have limitations, and I need to remember that. I want to tell you about this one period that I went through because I wasn't sure that God was going to be there for me, because I saw people going back out and I saw my friend die, blowing his brains out. And there were some things going on in my own family, and I was just in such despair in these rooms. And I wasn't certain that God was going to be there for me. So what I did is I came up with a plan. You know, we go to meetings and talk, you know, and we laugh at each other. You know, it's our plans that we're laughing at. And I had this plan. And this plan was I was going to give God one more chance. I was going to give him one more chance. Went to a grocery store, and this was my plan. I was going to take this grocery cart, and I was going to push it up and down all the aisles. And if he didn't give me a sign, I was going to get a bottle of Jack Daniels, and I was going to drink. So I get the cart, and I go around the first corner, and I come down the aisle, and I run into a friend from Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm shopping." See, I couldn't afford to let you know. I couldn't afford to let you know because I was afraid. I was afraid to let you know I was afraid. I was afraid you would think I was weak. So we chatted for a second, you know, and he went his way and I went my way and pushing my cart down the aisle. And I'm thinking, wow, God, that is really cool. I'll tell you what, God, if you will give me one more, sign and I won't drink. Okay? So then I go down a couple of aisles and I come around the corner and lo and behold, there's another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Wow. He comes up to me and says, "What are you doing?" "I'm shopping. That's what I'm doing." I couldn't tell him. I couldn't afford to. Got done with that. I went my way. He went his way. And I'm thinking, that is really cool. He gave me two signs. God, I tell you what. I'm only going to ask for one more. Please just give me one more, and then I'll be convinced that you're going to be there for me. And you're going to carry me through this difficult time. And I took my cart, and I pushed it up and down the aisles. And no one showed up. And I made it all the way over to the liquor department, and I got my bottle. I'm standing in the checkout line. There's only one person in front of me. That person just finished. And I'm getting ready to put the bottle up on the belt. And there's a tap on my shoulder. I turned around. There was another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what I've learned from that experience and many other experiences that I've had in these rooms. That when I have a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening, then it is my responsibility to maintain that fit spiritual condition. If I am spiritually fit, it is impossible for me to drink. God will not let it happen. It is impossible for it to happen. And I've had that experience time and time again, time again. See, this is what I discovered as a result of having a sponsor who had big book sobriety and understood the recipe in this book. See, the authors have spent one-third of the... I'm talking about the first 164 pages. The authors have spent one-third of the book on step one alone. One-third. They spend one-third on the action steps, which is steps 4 through 9. And then they spend one-third on the strict disciplines of 10, 11, 12. So let's say I go through the steps one time, do one inventory, finish my amends, and I'm resting on 10, 11, 12. I'm only utilizing one-third of the program. See, I've been taught to do repeated inventories and to continue to go through the steps again and again and again and again. Why? Because there's a key word in step 12, and that key word is practice. Practice is defined as something I do repeatedly. So you see, that hamburger I had yesterday isn't going to sustain me today. That prayer meditation I did yesterday isn't going to sustain me today. So you see, I need new spiritual food on a daily basis. See, that's my responsibility. You know what that basically means? God does not keep me sober. How many times have you heard that one in meetings? God keeps me sober. Really? Well, let's see. If God keeps me sober, all I need is a book with one page on it, and it's going to say, "God keeps me sober, have a nice day." I don't have to do anything. I can do the steps one time, and I can rest on my laurels, and I can maintain that fit spiritual condition. That has not been my experience. Nor do I keep me sober. But as a result of doing the disciplines and gaining access to that power, then I get to stay sober. See, my book guarantees me that I will be given the power to help other people. It also guarantees me that I will receive new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction. That's in step two. That's a step two promise. New power. New! You ever bought a new car? You go out and you buy a new car, it's unlike anything I've ever had before. Totally unlike anything I've had before. New power, new peace. That means peace like I've never had before. New sense of direction. Sense of direction like I've never had before. As a result of that, this is my condition today. What I'm doing today in my sobriety. I do daily prayer and meditation. I do a daily 10-step. The 10-step tells us very clearly on page 84 that this is what we do as we go along throughout the day. Watch, ask, discuss, and turn. I'm going to watch for four things. So in other words, I got a four-wheel drive. I got four things I'm going to do, and I'm going to watch for four things. I'm going to watch for resentment, dishonesty, selfishness, and then fear. And then the authors instruct me to ask God at once to remove them. And then it says, discuss them with someone immediately. Immediately doesn't mean a week from now. It means that day. And then it says, we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Beautiful, beautiful practice. And then I do an evening review. That's clearly explained on page 86. And at the bottom of that review, those questions that I'm supposed to ask myself before I retire, it says that I'm going to ask for God's forgiveness. Okay, that's a prayer. Ask. And then I'm going to inquire what corrective measures should be taken. To inquire something, I need to listen. See, what I discovered about prayer and meditation is that I need to meditate in order to understand prayer and meditation. I'm not going to establish a relationship with the God of my understanding simply by prayer. It's like my friend Todd here. He calls me up and he says, hey, I'm having a party at my house. Come on over. I say, cool. And I hang up. I don't have the directions to get to his house. Which way am I going to go? So any relationship that I have today, it's two-way communication. It means I talk and then I listen. So you see, it's impossible for me to improve my relationship with the God of my understanding in step 11, nor am I going to receive the knowledge of his will or the power to carry it out if I'm not practicing daily prayer and meditation. I continue to go through the steps. I just recently, 2 weeks ago, did another 4-step. I maintain contact with my sponsor. I continue to sponsor other guys. One of the things I like to do is I like to have the guys that I work with to hold me accountable. What I've done is I have specifically gone to them and asked them to ask me specific questions on a regular basis. Paul, in the last 2 weeks, how often did you pray and meditate? Paul, in the last 2 weeks, how often have you done a daily 10? Paul, in the last 2 weeks, how often have you done an evening review? Paul, what step are you on? Paul, how often are you talking to your sponsor? Paul, how many guys are you sponsoring? Hey, Paul, what kind of meetings are you going to and how many? See, I need accountable. You know why? My book tells me I am self-deluded. Now, if I'm self-deluded, how am I going to know if I'm self-deluded? There's only one right answer to that question. I'm not going to know. Because if I'm self-deluded, what am I going to do? Rely on my self-delusion, let me know if I'm self-deluded? See, that's the most insane thing that we do in these rooms. We come into these rooms, you know, and we fight and kick and scream. Nobody does this but alcoholics. You know, you go to the guy and you say, do this or die. And he says, can I get back to you? What? 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 What's going on here? I mean, do the steps or die. Okay. Well, I need to think about it. Okay. Okay. You go do that. See, to know if I'm self-deluded is the same thing as going to a fish and ask yourself, how does a fish know it's in water? It doesn't know. It's impossible for me to know if I'm self-deluded.
I've had a couple of dry drunks in sobriety. And I could have drank. And solely through the grace of God, I did not drink. What happened was, I backed off on the meditation. Still did prayer, but I didn't do the meditation. You see, there's only one of two things that can happen to us in these rooms. We're either going to get better or we're going to get worse. There's no in between. I'm either going to get better or I'm going to get worse. And the question my sponsor will ask me often is, how free do you want to be? We'll be free just a little bit. We'll be free as much as you can possibly be. I want to be free. Today I am free because I'm willing to do the work. And in those periods where I wasn't willing to do the work, what happened to me was I became dishonest. I started keeping secrets. I almost lost my relationship with my wife as a result of it. And due to the love that I've received from my sponsor, her, and some other people, they sat me down and did an intervention on me. And he said, Paul, this is what you're doing. And you're getting worse. I couldn't argue that. It was the truth. See, love does not always look kind in these rooms. See, I thought love was something that was soft and mushy and squeezy and that. It doesn't always look kind. My very first sponsor loved me a great deal. He knew that I had nothing to offer in these meetings. These were his words, verbatim. He said, "You have nothing we want." No. He said, "You have nothing to offer." I said, "What do you have to offer? You haven't had a spiritual experience. You have a lot of opinions on experiences you've never had." He said, "I'll tell you what. I want you to go to meetings. I want you to shut up until you've gone through all 12 steps. You're actively making your 9-step amends. You're doing prayer meditation every day. You're doing an evening review every night. Then you have something to transmit." Our book tells us that. It says we cannot transmit something we don't have. And then he turned to me and he said, "I'll tell you what. You know that drinking you did and using those guns and using those needles?" He says, "If we ever need any help in that area, we'll call on you." What did I have to offer? I've been in and out of AA for 12 years. Couldn't put any sobriety together. Of course I couldn't put sobriety together. And then when I would put sobriety together, I would go to the people in AA and I would say, "Well, I put together X amount of sobriety." Now check out that statement. "I put together X amount of sobriety." Of course I did. That's why it was no good. See, I don't have the power to do that. I don't have the power to know when I'm self-deluded. I don't have the power to know when I need to be accountable. That's why I surround myself with people that will check those things out with me. Now, as a result of going through the steps and doing that work continually, my life has improved dramatically. I mean, it's just so far removed. See, I had no idea that I was going to be sober this long. It was not in my plans. I came back in 1981 to AA just wanting to buy a little bit of time, get people off my back, not wanting to go back to the penitentiary. That's why I came back. That's why the guy that comes in and says, "I'm not sure if I want to stop drinking," I love him. Because I relate to that guy, kicking and screaming. If you're breathing, there's hope. If you will follow the recipe in this book, I can guarantee you your life will change. I mean, all kinds of wonderful stuff is happening in my life. I mean, if I had known I was going to be sober this long, I would have done a much better job along the way. I would have. I would have gotten out of sooner. I would have been willing sooner. I would have made the amends sooner. Blah, 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 blah. You know, I would have done them. So when it came time to doing that inventory and then having to go make those amends, and amends like having to go back and make amends to those three police officers. Because I remember thinking, staying sober is my amend. That's not what the book says. It says we must take the lead. I didn't make that amend until I was sober 12 years. That's how deluded I was. So, when I committed that armed robbery on that Taco Bell, and there was another guy that did it with me, you know what I wanted to do? I wanted to go in and make that amend and say, "Yo, my friend Joe was with me too," you know. But the book doesn't say that. It says we gain consent. We set aside what they did. So it was necessary for me to go back to that Taco Bell and make that amend. I remember having to go back to the neighborhood that I grew up in Tucson. And when I was a kid, what we used to do is we used to drive through the neighborhoods, and we had a piece of cold rolled steel about that big around, about that long. And I was the hitter. And I got to lean out the window and smack all these mailboxes and destroy them. Now, do I want to stay sober? How free do I want to be? My book asks me, am I willing to go do any length to stay sober? So I found it necessary to go back to that neighborhood and knock on every single door. "Hey, in 1967, did you lose a mailbox?" That's what I found necessary. Why? Because that's what the recipe calls for. The ninth step is a beautiful step. It's a freedom step. And as a result of that, I'm able to do things today that are just, I mean, it's beyond my comprehension the way my life is going and things I'm able to do. I mean, I'm driving down the street, you know, and I'm thinking, wow, listen to the birds. And looking at all those beautiful people on that freeway in Phoenix as I'm driving to my job, and thinking, wow, these are some cool people, you know. Have you ever noticed how people around you start changing when you're doing the steps? All of a sudden they get nicer. They seem more loving. They haven't changed. It's me.
You know, I'll be driving down the street and something will pop into my head. Some guy, you know, that I haven't heard from in a couple of weeks and go, I wonder how he's doing. That's not me. I was self-consumed, egocentric, selfish, self-centered. The only person I thought about was me, 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 me. Speaking of your 13-step dance, I remember the first couple of dances I went to, and I was so nervous about those things. You know, I was so afraid. My sponsor said, what are you so afraid of? People are going to be watching me. He said, no, they're not. They're looking at themselves. They're too busy looking at themselves. They don't have time for you. But by the way, those dances did teach me something. You know, they taught me that I couldn't find Miss Wright there. Especially in this right now. But, no, it taught me how to have fun is what it taught me, you know. But, you know, just some beautiful things are happening in my life. Another example of the loving thoughts that pop into my head. I'll probably pay for this later. Jan's going to probably have something to say about it, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway. She comes to me one day, and she wants me to go to a concert with her. She says, Paul, would you go to a Neil Diamond concert with me? Now, I want to do the loving thing because that's the loving thing to do. See, that's what this program has taught me. It has taught me to do loving things. It has taught me that love is a discipline. Love is not a feeling. This is a program of action. I know it's important to her. So I go to the concert with her because it's important to her. It means something to her. That's what the... Doing this work again and again and again, that's the impact it's had on my life. So we go to the concert, and we're standing out there on the line, and she turns to me and she says, sweetheart, are you afraid somebody that you know is going to see you here? I said, no, not at all. Now, what's in my mind, but I didn't tell her was, sweetheart, no one I know is going to be here. See, I grew up on different music than she did, okay? And... But the point is, the love that I experience today and the love that comes out of my heart as a result of finding a God of my understanding. My book tells me that I am in a position of neutrality. I am safe and protected. The problem has been removed. It does not exist for me. I am neither cocky nor am I afraid. I am safe and protected. You know what that means? You can't hurt me. It is impossible for you to hurt me. Want to take my truck? Take it. I don't care. God's just going to give me another one. Want to rob me? Want to pull a gun, a knife on me, take all my money? Take it. God's just going to give me more money. Take my house. God will just give me another one. You want to kill? I don't kill me. Bring it on. I'm going to a better place. I'm here to tell you from personal experience. These are the promises that are mentioned throughout the book. If you want to try a little experiment, open your book and sometime and look in the table of contents and look up the chapter entitled The 12 Promises. You probably won't find it. You know why? It's not there. You know why? Because there are not 12 promises. There are promises throughout the entire book. Some alcoholic came up with that idea, 12 promises, and put it on the wall. There are a lot of limitations with those 12 promises. So you see, my book is filled with promises throughout the book. But the only way I'm going to get to experience that is to follow the recipe in the book. Now, the way I sponsor today, because I have a responsibility. My book doesn't tell me that I go to meetings and kick back and wait for the newcomer to come to me. It says I have a responsibility to seek them out. So if I need to work with a new guy, I may be at a meeting and there may be 8, 9, 10 people I want to hug from and there's a new guy there. It's my responsibility to seek them out. I sponsor guys who, some of them are not real active with working with others. See, my book tells me that working with others is the foundation stone of my recovery. It is the foundation stone of my recovery. I must work with other alcoholics. And if you don't work with other alcoholics, you know, it's really hard to convey to people You know, maybe you can remember the time, you know, the first time you had sex. You know? I mean, it was a cool thing, wasn't it? For some of us, it was. Okay. But I remember being around that age, you know, and you hear people talk about it, and you go, what are they talking about? I couldn't convince. And when I had it, I was like, wow, you just can't believe what happened. This thing happened, and these Jews did this, and we did this, and did that, and I felt this, and I felt that. And they're looking at you like, what? What is that? I can't convey that experience of working with another alcoholic. Invariably what happens for me, because I'm still a self-centered alcoholic. And you know, there are some guys I sponsor, and I'm glad that a lot of them aren't here tonight, because they probably think I'm talking about them, you know, but there's some of my sponsor, you know, they're the kind of guy, you know, I don't want to spend time with them, and I put them in the car, I'm driving down, they're the kind of guy you're driving down the street and the street lights dim, you know, they just... Emotional vampires want to suck me dry, you know, and I'm supposed to meet with one of these guys, and there's a Suns game or a Diamondbacks game. I want to watch the game. I don't want to be with him, you know, because I know he's going to whine, and then I'm going to have to turn around and call my sponsor and whine about his whining, you know. So I'm driving on the way over there, and you know what? You know what motivates me to continue to do that? The experience of what happens sitting down one-on-one with another alcoholic. Invariably, this is what happens. I get there, and I can't tell you exactly when it happens, but it happens. And this is what happens. I sit there, and I'm filled with abundance, and I'm filled with gratitude. And I find myself saying, God, thank you for allowing me to spend time with this alcoholic. And then I leave, and the next week I'll go through it all over again, you know? But what I've learned as a result of going through the work in this book and the way my sponsor sponsored me, I basically sponsored the same way he sponsored me. The guys that I sponsor, when they're new, they don't talk in meetings. They do not talk in meetings. What do they have to offer? Not until they've had a spiritual experience. See, I was taught that our meetings are supposed to be pep rallies. That's what they are. They are not a place for me to bring my problems. That's what the sponsor is for. It's a place for me to go and hear the vision of hope. I go to meetings, I need to hear hope. I need to hear the purity of the message. My home group, which happens to be the Big Book Experience meeting, we ask that you not share your opinions in this meeting. That if you do not have an experience with what we're discussing, we ask that you pass. And that if you deviate from the topic, or you start sharing your opinion rather than your experience, the chairperson will ask you to pass, so may others can share. So, we go to this meeting, and people leave on fire. They're on fire. Why? Because they're hearing the vision of hope. They're hearing the purity of the message. That is not the purpose of meetings, is to take problems there. I remember in that 12 years, and even in the time I've been sober now, I've been to meetings, and I felt worse when I left. Why? Because I'm not hearing the vision of hope. We have a responsibility to make our meetings pep rallies. We're losing people. We're losing them. They're dying. I have a responsibility. My job is to do God's work. This is what I've discovered as a result of doing this work in that book and doing God's work. God does not have any favorites. But I'll tell you what, He pays His workers really well. He pays them really well. See, today I sponsor people like a mailman. I'm a mailman. I deliver the mail and then I leave. When the mailman delivers my mail, he doesn't stick around and wait for me to read it. That's my job. It's none of my business what he does with the mail. How do I determine whether or not I am successfully sponsoring people? If I'm taking them through the work. If I'm taking them through the 12 steps. The same way my sponsor took me through it, because he knew I needed to get to that power. He knew I needed to get to it quick, and I needed it now, because I was a desperate alcoholic, and I came to these rooms, and I was dying, man. I did not have the power to keep me sober. And if I do have the power, I don't need to be here with you. That's why I need to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I don't have the power. I still don't have the power. That's why it's important for me to revisit step one and have a first step experience again. Not up here in my head, down here in my gut. Revisit the powerlessness, the despair, the anxiety, the futility, the hopelessness, the helplessness. I need to experience that again and again and again, because if I don't, I have no desire to seek that power. So basically, how I sponsor people today could best be illustrated in this story. This little boy goes out to the woods, and he sees a cocoon hanging from the tree. And he sees a butterfly in that cocoon, and he wants to help it. So he pulls out his pocket knife, and he opens the cocoon so the butterfly can get out. The butterfly was able to get all the way out of the cocoon, and then he falls to the ground and dies. And he runs home. He says, "Daddy, Daddy, I tried to help this butterfly, and he died. What happened?" The father says, "Well, son, you know, that butterfly needed to struggle so he could develop the strength so he could fly." That's how I love the guys that I work today. See, I only have three responsibilities with the guys I work with. Number one is to take them through the steps. Number two is to tell them the truth. And number three is to love them. That means to let them struggle. I don't have the answers, but the book does. See, I don't have the power to keep them sober. You don't have the power to keep me sober. My book's real clear on that. It says, no human power. It has to come from God. So if I can stay sober, anybody can stay sober. And there's no reason why each and every one of us in these rooms goes back out into our groups and turn your meetings into pep rallies. And let the power of God shine through you in the works that you do with your fellow alcoholics. To take the whining and the complaining and take it to the sponsor, take it to the coffee after the meeting, and carry the vision of hope in those meetings. So when the new guy comes in, he wants to come back because he's hearing hope. That's my responsibility. There is no way that I could ever repay Alcoholics Anonymous for what it's given me in my lifetime. There's no way. Because based on what I knew when I came into these rooms, it's impossible to get from there to here based on what I knew. So there's nothing that comes out of my mouth today that is original. Nothing. It's all as a result of doing the work again and again and again. And if you go through the steps and you think that you can rely on steps 10, 11, and 12 and use only one-third of the program, just stop and ask yourself this question. Are you happy with every single area of your life? And how free do you want to be? There's no reason why each and every one of us can be here a year from tonight. Wouldn't that be beautiful? That would be absolutely beautiful. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come out tonight. And it's been an honor, a pleasure, and as I said before, this conference rocks, and you people are beautiful. Thank you very much. I love you.